Send it to him, if you can. So I have three items on my agenda for today. No, that's good. That's
it. Did you need audio today?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So I have three items on the agenda. One is to work through these materials that I have sent you. The second is to ask you to help me focusing on an op-ed issue in relationship to Governor Patrick. And third is to talk about the projects and when we're gonna start in them. And in just putting that in your mind, what I'm thinking about is that I'd like to have a class activity in which each of you make your argument and also describe your strategy for bringing attention to your argument, for projecting your argument. And I'd like to build a series of class sessions and workshop discussions around those questions for each one of you. Like, how good is your argument? You know, how strong it is? How well presented it is? How well put together it is? So forth. And then, what's your strategy for projection? All right, now, the materials I sent you. The core of the story in these materials is the American Jury. And the core issue that the story turns on is the issue of nullification, which is actually an expression of the balance of power between the judge, the court, and the jury, the people. So the story, the story of the American Jury should be somewhere right in the first semester of law school. I can't really understand why it isn't, in its way, the most fundamental of fundamentals to be taught in American law. You see this history of here. It's quite condensed, but the jury starts its existence as an efficiency measure, a way in which a distant power can rule and keep order in remote environments, and starts with first the idea of the grand jury as a body of people from an area who themselves decide what should be prosecuted as crime, and then petit juries who were people that had decided whether the specific crimes had taken place. And these were run by a system of traveling judges where the strategy appears to be to provide a governance mechanism in which the judge is not responsible for the outcome, because responsibility for the outcome brings all sorts of flack with it. From their point of view, if they can create an administrative governance system which works okay, the economy functions, and the judges stay clear of it in terms of taking blame for what happens, that's a success. All right, and then you see the jury go through some very early changes that have to do with peculiarities of English history, the role that the death penalty played at the beginning. At the beginning of this system, there's no system of jails, so there's no intermediate punishment that's really available to the courts. You have basically punitive measures, so you've got a system of extremes. And initially, if you were a felon, you were executed. And with the jury system in that context, there was some natural tendency for juries to reflect something beyond the technicality of the law, having to do with whether the person should be executed. And so you begin to get the seeds of jury beginning to feel it has a role to play. And you also get the sense of, begin to get the sense of the way the jury actually is an invitation to the kind of middle class of the society, not the people who are ruling in power, and not the people who are against the society, but kind of like a mid-group to come in and participate and be responsible in some sense for the setting of the norms by which whatever the locality is governing itself. It's an enterprise, the beginning of an enterprise in self-governance. And then you have these marvelous stories of how the jury came to be seen and to see itself as a source and protector of freedom. So, did anyone here really read the Penn trial? Yeah? This is a wonderful story. You owe it to yourselves to dig into it and read it. This is William Penn, for whom the great state of Pennsylvania is eventually named because of a land grant to him when he matures and becomes a really powerful lord. But in his youth, he was totally a rebel. I guess a rebel all along. Was a Quaker, which was about as rebellious as you could get in terms of the Anglican religious dominated structure. And he gets arrested and prosecuted for preaching in the streets. Actually, they had locked his church, and so when he couldn't go in, he and his associate, Meade, conducted a sermon in the streets and gathered a great multitude, and they were then prosecuted. And a dispute effectively arises between the judge, who asserts that the only question on which guilt depends is whether they in fact spoke in the street. But that would be an unlawful assembly, and therefore the jury should find them guilty of unlawful assembly if they found that he spoke in the street. And an element within the jury, led by apparently a guy named Bushnell, who wouldn't let the jury come to that conclusion. They insisted merely on saying that he had spoken, but not that he had engaged in an unlawful assembly. And it starts a kind of a war between the trial judge and the jury, in which the judge is threatening to hold them in contempt. And it's in a structure that previously had actually held juries responsible if they didn't make the right finding as the court saw the facts. And they wind up returning a verdict of not guilty. And Bushnell is then himself held in contempt. And his case becomes a second case at which the House of Lords actually establishes that the jury has the right to find the facts. But the real case I'd like you to look at for purposes of thinking Cyber One is the great case that follows it in the United States. That's the case of John Peter Zenger. So actually open the document, if you would, to the article by Dwyer that tells the story of the case of John Peter Zenger. This is a great story that involves a great lawyer. It becomes a rock-solid connection between the jury and free speech, freedom of speech. The case in which the phrase "a Philadelphia lawyer" became known, because the great lawyer was Hamilton of Philadelphia, who came up to defend John Peter Zenger, who was a printer. He put out a little newspaper that was very critical of the governor of New York, the appointed English governor, who was prosecuting Zenger for seditious libel. And Zenger had said in the newspapers all sorts of things about the governor. The judicial position was that the only thing the jury was supposed to do was determine whether he had said those things. It was up to the judge to decide whether they were libelous. And Hamilton comes in to defend Zenger and starts right out by saying, "This case is not about whether he said these things. It's about whether they are true and whether they're libelous." And there's then just wonderful byplay with the judge, which has come down, going back and forth on the power of judge and jury. Who decides whether it's libelous, and is truth a defense? Just take 5 minutes and just read it through. So what do you make of this case? What's important about it? What's curious about it? Yes, Dave.
It seems, I don't know if you could do something like this today. Like, it just seemed like you could draw on this higher law, like these kinds of ideals of freedom and liberty, and openly say almost that the, you know, the state of law isn't as relevant as these other things. And then the jury can kind of, you know, listen to that instead. I wonder if in a courtroom today you could do that, say, you know, who cares what the law is? This is the right thing. This is, you know, what's good. I don't know if procedure is allowed, but it seems like now there's more strength.
Well, we'll talk about that. It's definitely, he's definitely making a nullification argument.
Right.
He's definitely arguing to the jury in a way that self-consciously recognizes and asks them to recognize that they are the judges of the law. Yes. How does he get away with it here? You have a sense of Hamilton from just this little excerpt that you have? With the judge. Do you see him at any point in direct opposition to the judge? Is he at any point in contempt? I think so. He seems to have mastered the art of being interpersonally completely respectful, so that in no sense is he challenging the judge's authority in the courtroom in a, what would you say, antagonistic way. He's always got an argument for what he's doing. And he's willing to make nice to the judge as he's going along. So it's not like he's behaving badly in the courtroom. He's at no point in defiance. And just as a matter of tactic, that's excellent. That's not the fight he wants. So the picture of a lawyer who comes into the courtroom with a chip on his shoulder, you know, the radical lawyer, the cause lawyer, often is working uphill right from the beginning because they present in a way that puts the judge against them as a matter of manner before you even get to substance.
So much as he sort of sidestepped the courtroom as the framework in which he wants to operate. I mean, he's using sort of the rhetoric of the day about, you know, the loss of liberty and tyranny and all of that.
Yes.
So he's reframed it outside of the sort of sphere of the courtroom. And
yes.
It's just a bigger thing that they have to deal with. It's not really a legal issue.
Well, he's also got a handle on what it means to be libelous.
Sure.
And how the truth relates.
Sure.
And he goes through a very nice little byplay with the judge's instruction on it, which he seems to have anticipated and have been prepared for. And so he winds up having an argument about the argument,
right,
which allows him to say everything he wants to say. So this is a noticeable expression, I think, of the importance of the jury in the protection of constitutional liberty, with the nullification rule a kind of governor on the process that the judges try to keep their hands on, but it can get out of control, and it can be let out of control. So Zenger stands as an example of a case in which the government is overreaching. The government is abusing with the prosecutorial power. And the jury stands as the bulwark against it. And the lawyer's ability to speak to the jury becomes the doctrinal frame within which the struggle for control goes on. All right, now, within that structure, you can imagine the prosecutor being one force and the judge being another. Right. In the Zenger case, you're at least led to believe on this telling of it that the judge is pretty much a loyalist. But suppose you have an issue on which the judge doesn't quite see eye to eye with the prosecutor. And now we've got the judge, the governor, in the sense of the arbiter of the rules by which the procedure goes forward, which basically are the rules that delimit the freedom of the lawyer to make an argument in terms of scope and in terms of witnesses. So there's a lot of judicial power in there that can be appealed to and used, and even some jury power that can be appealed to and used. So there's an article that follows this in that reading that kind of gives you a quick review of nullification as a doctrine coming down since Zenger. There was a time in American history in which it was simply understood that the jury is the arbiter of the law. When you came off of the Zenger case, and that then becomes a story of freedom in revolutionary United States, and all the states are adopting jury as part of their constitution, the idea of jury that they have in mind is the Zenger jury. It's the Bushnell jury. And so for an early period, nullification was in. Now, I'm not a particular historian of the periods. My understanding is that Morty Horowitz, for example, looks at the process of the courts taking control back from juries as an expression of the Industrial Revolution. As you get greater class divides and you get expressions of corporate power, the law expresses a need for taking greater control from juries. And so somewhere along through the 1850s, nullification goes the other way. And the idea that the judge decides the law becomes the rule. But it's been fought at any number of points, and mostly they're points having to do with freedom arguments. So, the readings describe a Vietnam War era case in which some people who were protesters sought to establish the right to give the jury a nullification instruction. See, it's an interesting issue because the jury clearly does have the power to nullify the law. No one now disputes that. If the jury says not guilty, then that's it. And the judge has no power to direct a verdict of guilty. So if a citizen pleads not guilty, they have a right to have the jury decide, and the jury has the power to acquit, period. And so the argument for nullification is tell the jury the power they have. Instruct them, let them understand that, and go from there. But interestingly, I think the way the nullification argument was framed in the Vietnam case was really an assertion that every defendant had a right to a nullification instruction in every case. And again, if you think about this as a control mechanism that the judiciary has within its power, it certainly doesn't want to give it up in every case. If it's going to be thought of as a control mechanism, what you should be looking for is some kind of doctrinal structure, some kind of argument to the judges as to what kinds of cases they should allow the lever to let up in. That is, can we conceive a category of cases in which nullification instruction is appropriate, arguing the law to the jury is appropriate, as opposed to other cases in which it's not?
Who's to say?
Very good question. Who's to say? Well, it's a very clear answer. Who's to say?
Well, you know the answer.
Who's the answer? What's the answer?
Well, apparently it's a jury.
No. On this one, no.
On this one, it's
on the instruction, that the appeal to the judge to allow the argument to be made to the jury. The choice is definitely the judge.
Sure.
All right, now, it's a very good question, so you think about that. Does the judge have the power to do this?
It depends on, I guess, our conception of what the jury is supposed to do.
No, I'm asking a question. Does the judge have the power to do it? Well, who would say? Well, how would you say? Does the judge have the power to do it? How many would say yes, the judge has the power to do it? How many would say no, the judge doesn't have the power to do it?
You need to end the civil procedures to see if there's anything actually.
No. Come now, come. Does the judge have the power to do it? Who's going to stop the judge? All right, I'm the judge. This is my courtroom. I'm about to do it. Who's going to stop me? Is there anyone here who's going to stop me? All right, then I'm doing it. Do I have the power or not? We do it, then it's done. And Mr. Hamilton, go ahead, speak. Say your piece.
I mean, you have the immediate power to do it.
Yes, exactly. That is the power to do it.
But, I mean, unless you consider yourself bound by ulterior rules.
Talk to me.
In the same sense, the defendant's lawyer has the same power to do it as he could say it.
Except when he stands up to do it, the judge can have him put in contempt for doing it. And so, yes, he can do it, but he pays a price for doing it. And yes, that's a whole other calculus as to whether you want to pay that price. And under many situations, you would. But I'm saying the judge can do it, and hey, nothing stops him.
But I mean, there's a price after that he may pay.
Yeah, what's the price?
Okay, there's several. There's the price in that him doing it is obviously going to generate publicity, so that he has his personal reputation is on the line in whatever sense. You hope he could divorce himself from it.
Yes, that's right. My personal reputation is going to be on the line. That's exactly right.
There's the chance that, I don't know, but then here, you say he gave the wrong direction. There's a chance that he gave the wrong direction to the jury. There could be appeal on the basis of his direction to the jury was incorrect.
No.
You can't do that.
Wrong. Think it through. What happens after? We give the instruction. Then what happens next? Well, one of two things happen. The defendant gets acquitted, or the defendant gets convicted. Now, if the defendant gets acquitted, if the defendant gets convicted, all right, the defendant can appeal. But the defendant certainly has no appeal on the ground that I granted the right to him to argue broadly to the jury. The defendant gets acquitted. End of case.
So there's no right appeal.
It's done.
In the UK, you appeal it, but you wouldn't be able to get a conviction.
Prosecutors don't appeal the conviction.
They can appeal the direction. They can't appeal the direction either.
Nope.
Do you run a risk of losing judicial credibility? I mean, if you take unilateral corporate actions because there's no one there to stop you in a way that leads to an acquittal for the accused, I mean, how many times can you play that card before the public simply won't stand for it anymore?
What makes you think the public wouldn't stand for it? Remember, a jury acquits the person.
I mean, I understand, but I mean, if it's a question of manipulating judicial rules in a way that appeals to the jury or plays to common sense, you're going to run into the immediate reaction of the prosecutor and the team that feels like they've been unfairly played. It's going to be to go to the court of public opinion. And they're going to accuse you as a judge of manipulating the rules of the court to favor the cases that you found to be sympathetic. So they're going to say that justice isn't being carried equally. But instead, as a judge, you're choosing which defendants that you like, and you're allowing their lawyers to operate unilaterally without any respect to the court's rules. And enough times, that happens more than once or twice or three times, you're going to face a public uproar that's either going to remove you from your judicial appointment or you're just going to lose credibility in the judicial system. In the very same way that you said, like, you know, who's to stop a judge from doing that? The judge also has literally no ability whatsoever to enforce the rule of law outside of their courtroom, because who's going to enforce that law?
No, I think you're just mushing things together here, Andrew. I said the judge has the power to do it. Yes, I'll say that. And yes, I'll agree with you that the judge has certainly got, should have some exercise of responsibility in doing it, which distinguishes the category of cases for which it's appropriate from those for which it's inappropriate. All right, so the question is there a category of case for which it's appropriate for me to use my power in a way that allows the jury to have a greater say, right?
Doesn't it depend on whether or not you buy into the system?
I believe this is the system.
I mean, like for me, like that, just the very question of is there a category of cases in which case
yes.
It's relevant to me, like it depends on how much you trust the system. Like, if you trust the system, like that the system is, you know, it's a good system and it's the best system that we can design, then I feel like you can't distinguish between types of cases, because you have to take the standpoint that the system is designed to mitigate human error, for instance.
Except that I look at the system and it clearly works a whole lot of injustices. It's not perfect. And I would rather think of the system as including me as a human being who was put in this position as a judge, not to be an automaton, but to actually exercise the power of my office in a way that advances the cause of law and good sense in the society.
I mean, that's a very valid point. I mean,
absolutely.
What
the hell am I here for?
I mean, it's just a bit. Well, I mean, like, some people would say that a judge isn't supposed to use the power of his office. The judge is supposed to operate essentially as a referee, and he is simply there.
Well, what do you think? How should the judge operate? Suppose you are the judge, in.
It's a hard question, because I tend to think of this in political terms. Like, to me, rather than a judge, because I think of it like when you think of an elected representative, and the way I always think about questions like this, or if you're supposed to exercise your power and your morality or not, is when you elect an elected official, if you're an elected official, is your duty to reflect the viewpoint of your constituents, or is it your duty to, or do you take, do you interpret their voting for you as a vote towards your moral sense, right? And so I think, like, if you're a congressman, are you supposed to reflect what your constituents say or what you know to be right? And so, like, in a political sense, I would say that you are supposed to reflect what your constituents say, regardless of whether or not you think it's right. Like, that would tend to be my position on it. With a judge, though, it's...
You're going to make a great lawyer. Hire you for anything. Whatever my client says, that's right. It doesn't make any difference if it's, I think it's moral. Too bad it's, I believe it's immoral, it's true, but... It's for my client, and I'm going to do it. And it's my constituents that want this, so I'm going to go for it.
Because, I mean, when a judge starts exercising his strength in the position, it screams to me, sort of, has an oligarchy nature to it. Or, I mean, it has this sort of educated elites dictating.
Yes, it has judgment in it.
It does.
It has wisdom in it. It has an understanding of judicial power.
It seems undemocratic to me. It seems undemocratic that an official who oftentimes is appointed or whatever should offer judgment. That I tend to think that, like, yeah, it's, I don't know. I really don't have my mind made up on this.
The power that he's executing here, though, is to give citizenry power against.
That was the back end that I got to there in my argument, where I said, I don't know. I don't know what I think of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like basically giving the people power against the man is the execution power.
All right, so here you are. You're my law clerk. I'm the judge here. And I'm thinking that I should... Well, how should I think about it? I'm being asked by a defendant to be able to argue to the jury that he shouldn't be held guilty, even though he, fill in the blank, violated the statute. Under what circumstances might I sensibly consider doing that?
I think not at all.
Never.
Can you repeat that? The last
part. I've been asked to allow the defendant to argue to the jury, through counsel or himself or herself, that the jury should acquit, even though the factual predicate for the statute has been proven. That is, to make, to reflect a judgment that the application of the law to this defendant would be unjust.
This is kind of a stupid question, but would that set precedent to invalidate the statute in cases like that?
No.
No.
It would be a single instance. It would be the kind of signaling of juries that took place during Prohibition, when they acquitted people and are basically sending a message to the government, stop prosecuting these people. This is, you're going too far. It's like seeing the jury as the conscience of the middle of the society, able to say to the authorities at the top, stop prosecuting these people the way you're doing. It's wrong. Just like the jury in the Zenger case says in the context of Governor Clark.
The question is whether or not they can do it legitimately. And I think there are two sort of ways you can look at it. First is you can say, you know, if the people who make the laws, the Congress, wanted them to be able to do this, they would have, you know, written in the law that you can do this, or written in the Constitution that you can do this. And the other take is that, well, since they didn't explicitly write it out, then it's, you know, the fact of the matter is that they can do this and it's okay. But for me, it's, you know, a clear example in which, you know, no one elected these people. These are people who are selected at random. 12 people or 8 people get to choose whether or not a law is right or wrong in this particular instance. Not whether it's contradicted with another law, not a judicial question, but a question of whether or not this is a good law. And
as applied to this person in this context.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Absolutely. And I don't think that's the appropriate place of 12 people that no one elected.
So you would have strung Bushnell up. You would have convicted William Penn and me. You would have directed the verdict, effectively entered the verdict against Zenger. You would have backed up the governor's seditious libel.
Isn't the question, though, here, I mean, at least when I think about the state policy standpoint, it's not relevant in the cases where justice is so obviously miscarried by the enforcement of the rules, but it's how does, like, essentially making an exception for these cases that seem to have the force of justice behind them, how does that affect the day-to-day practice? I mean, how many times is it, because I mean, it's all varying degrees of perspective, right? So I mean, how many times then, if you allow judges to do this in these situations, is the defendant who feels himself to be innocent going to feel that he never did anything wrong? I mean, where's the line? You know, how far is the slippery slope?
Right, Tim, we're still on. Where's the line? That's what I want to know. If I'm going to do this, can I do it in one case and not do it in all?
I don't know. I think you should back up. Like, when is it ever the case that, you know, you or I or jury gets to decide that this is obviously wrong?
The Gennaro Wilson case?
The which one?
Gennaro Wilson, the guy who got, he's like a high school student, he had consensual sex with a 15-year-old, he was 17 at the time, or it wasn't sex, it was oral sex. And it was taped.
Had it been sex, it would have been
yeah.
Legal.
And the law said that if you had oral sex with someone under whatever age, you get 10 years of prison. This kid was like a straight-A student, this was the only thing he had done, or he didn't have any, did he have any prior? He didn't.
He was 17, she was 15.
And they convicted him, and then the jury later was like, we didn't realize the sentence was so severe. Mm-hmm. I don't think, they didn't know about jury nullification, and I think everyone kind of thought it was crazy. He's out now, because I think they appealed
it. They just changed the law.
Yeah,
they didn't
make it retroactive, which doesn't even make sense. But what
happened in that case was this was such a huge shot to justice that it actually forced the legislature to change the entire law. They rewrote the law to say that if it was two minors, or I think they gave like a window, if it was like within like 3 years of age, then something like this, because the law was initially meant to target like child molesters and like things like that. It obviously was not meant to target two high school kids who engaged in some act together. So they rewrote the law, and then, so they were gonna let him go, and the appellate court said, no, you can't retroactively apply a law to overturn sentences that were given before the law, because they were saying, like, and I think their opinion said something like, yes, this is obviously a miscarriage of justice, but if we do it for this guy, we have to go back and like change sentences for a ton of people, and it presents this huge precedent problem. It was really interesting. He actually just got out after he spent 2 years in jail, or 3 years.
It was a long time, but also because he would have been categorized as a sex offender, he wouldn't have been able to live at home because he has a sister. So it was a huge deal.
I mean, it sounds to me, though, that the things worked out the way that they should have. I mean, with the exception of maybe the...
With the exception of the fact that this guy lost 2 years of his life?
Well, the law has to apply to everybody, right?
No. I mean, just think. All right, I'm the judge in this case, all right? And now I have the superpower of being able to see into the future.
You do.
Along one route, I apply the law the way Xander Lee believes it should be applied, which is stainless steel across everyone. There is no difference from one case to another.
Yeah.
We are just absolutely right.
Sure.
And we go along that route. This guy's life is ruined. He winds up getting raped in prison, all the bad things you can think of in that direction. Everyone recognizes total injustice. The legislature comes along, tries to fix it. Then the courts are in this awful position. If they fix this, then they have to wreck a whole bunch of other stuff. And so the courts have to basically say, no, we also are involved in this terrible injustice and this, we're helpless. As opposed to Xander saying to Mr. Hamilton, who's representing this kid, yes, you may argue to the jury
sure.
the justice of this case.
Sure.
I will allow you to tell the jury what the punishments are likely to be if they convict, at which point the jury acquits the kid, case finished, we're cooked, we're finished, we've got no problems.
What if the case was a little bit different and it was a case of some molestation, but the jury didn't want to give him 10 years, and so they acquit, not because he didn't do anything wrong, but because they think the sentence, mandatory sentence, is too harsh? I mean, it's never so cut and dry. I mean, that's what you're talking about is, you know, 0.01% of cases in which, you know, you might be able to
I only need mark. One case. All I need to start the ball rolling here
yeah.
is for you to admit that there would be at least one case that you can imagine in which I, as the sitting judge
yeah.
who run this court and talk about what procedures and who talks when and mm-hmm. what they can say and sustain objections and rule the court with an iron hand, can allow the lawyer to say a little bit more in this direction to avoid this awful path. I just need one case where
but
you admit that that would be a sensible exercise of the
path.
Power of my office.
There's a third path for all those cases in which you think path number one be appropriate. Third path is there's a governor who is elected who has the power to pardon people or to commute sentences. I mean, that's a third
Georgia
path.
Georgia State
we have
Supreme Court let him out October 26, 2007. He got his rule that his sentence was cruel and unusual.
And that, too.
So they let him out.
But I think that I understand what you're saying. You're saying if you do it once, you know, whatever, everyone will freak out and start nullifying. But
no, that's not my argument. My argument is who gets to decide?
The judge.
Any of these things. But like, why does the judge get to decide?
Because it's the judge. That's it. So that's why
you put
in charge of this process in order to run the process. It's not mechanical.
I mean, why do you think that someone who is elected has more is more democratic than a group of citizens? It doesn't really make sense to me. Like, they're actually sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of the citizenry.
Sure.
It's a group of them.
Right.
And presumably they're diverse now.
Sure.
So doesn't it make sense that what they decide is also sort of democratic? I mean,
do you want 12 random people to be your next Congress?
In a situation in which the judge thinks this is an extraordinary case in
uh-huh.
which a mechanical application of the law is likely to lead to an injustice,
sure.
I will open the possibility that a jury of peers
mm-hmm.
will recognize that and avoid the injustice. There's also a possibility they'll convict. But
sure.
at least then it'll be backed up by a jury verdict. It won't simply be the arbitrary enforcement.
But, I mean, at least the arbitrary enforcement of justice, or I would say non-arbitrary enforcement of justice, is something that we've sort of all agreed to do, and at least in sort of, you know, first level. We have a democratic process, we agree to this constitution and all of that. But if you open this pathway for judges to decide, you know, what is looks like to be too harsh of a sentence or you know whatever, unjust, and then you allow this other pathway for juries to actually act on that, then you open the possibility for, you know, perversions of justice at the same time, which we have seen, where, you know, white supremacists get let out by juries who refuse to convict them. I mean, this is, you get both sides of the coin, and we don't agree to it because it's arbitrary. I mean, who gets to decide? Well, not the people that I want. I want to be able to decide what's a good law and what's a bad one, and within this democratic process. I don't want 12 random people deciding it on the spot.
So would you, can you ever imagine yourself taking a position as judge, getting appointed as a judge?
Sure.
And you would like that job?
Well, definitely.
Why?
That I would like to be able to do this, to do what you're saying?
Yes, you would be, on what would you be exercising judgment?
I'm not so sure that judges should be in the business of exercising judgment in the sense that you're saying.
Unless it's you.
No, even if it's not. No, I wouldn't do it.
So if you were a judge, you'd just mechanically apply the law?
I'm there to apply the law and to, you know, as it's been written out for me by someone else. I don't get to decide those laws.
That's based on a very, you know, very simplistic idea of kind of jurisprudence and what the...
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's basically formalism, which pretty much died a long time ago.
Apparently not.
But really, because there's idealism as well. I mean, there's very few people that would argue formalism in a sense that exists now. I mean, even Hart, who is, you know, about as formal as you get, he would argue, there's always a number, it's words, it's not something which is mechanical, it's words, and there's always,
sure,
whatever you do, there's always going to be some area where you have to exercise discretion.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, don't worry, like, there's, obviously, if, you know, the law is unclear, and, you know, you're a judge and you have to make a decision based on an unclear law, then you have to make a decision one way or another. You can't, you know, sit back and say that I can't make a decision.
Well,
because
so what's your authority?
Pretty much every law is unclear, so it's, I think that's very...
No, but when, I mean, what we're talking about here is when the law is clear, when
but
the law,
if
applied,
would
lead to a conclusion
that we don't
like. But
it's not clear because if the law says you can't have oral sex with somebody under 15, there's no clarity in thinking that the Congress who wrote that law was thinking, oh, especially, even if you're 16, this law applies to you, even if you're 17, this law applies to
you. It doesn't matter what they're thinking, it matters what it says.
Legislative intent definitely matters when you're looking at a statute.
It's underground.
All right, so hold on, I want to move this, let me move the discussion forward here. Take a look at the lease case. Open it up. This is the case that's a challenge to the marijuana law litigated by Harvey Silverglade. And just read into it a little bit so that you
get a sense of where the case is procedurally. This is 1969. All right, so just stop here. You see this opening paragraph? So they're prosecuted for unlawful possession. They're found guilty in the district court. That's like the Boston Municipal Court. That's tried to a judge. And appeals were filed in the Superior Court. You appeal from the district court for a de novo proceeding in the Superior Court. The defendants in the Superior Court file motions to dismiss the complaints, asserting that the statute relating to possession is unconstitutional. And then, here, this is the sentence I would like you to look at. After a lengthy hearing at which 18 expert witnesses testify, the trial judge denies the defendant's motion but reports the case on the following questions. This is a Massachusetts process of reporting a question on which the judge is in doubt. So what do you think of what the trial judge did? What did he do? What did the trial judge do? He allowed the plaintiff, the defendant, to build a record. The judge holds a hearing. Now that's amazing in itself, right? You go in and you persuade a judge who has the power to do it to say, all right, we'll hold a hearing on this question. I'll take your question seriously. Now, just in that, you can immediately see a judge getting involved in the issue, sending a message, and then allowing a record to get built, 18 witnesses strong. That's a bunch of time. That's days. And then reporting the question. So he's going to make another court deal with it on a record. Now, what do you think of that? Was that judge misbehaving?
That seems fundamentally different because he's not exercising any incredible judicial power. All the power he's exercising is within the rules that have been given to him to define his conduct. He's
exactly.
Just doing something that's somewhat unusual.
Yes.
And allowing a hearing with 18 expert witnesses, which I've never heard before.
Yes. Yes.
So this reminds me a little bit of something you said yesterday, Andrew, which is like kind of why certain test cases are better than others. Like, what he's doing here is saying there's some kind of fundamental reason, some ideal that I feel like matters to me and resonates with me, and I'd like them to kind of have a voice to be able to talk about this issue. And he's not kind of ignoring the law, but he's at least recognizing that he feels like this is important. And I think what happens when you have a good test case, and then maybe the cases where you should let the jury act, is when you've got a good instance of the kind of intuition that resonates with the judge. So it's like, this is just letting people speak. And then if you've got a good person that's kind of, you know, that fits the ideal that's motivating you to want them to speak, that kind of makes for a good test case or a case where you should let the jury hear the argument.
Was this a good test case? Who were the defendants in this case? Were they the little old lady who needed to smoke marijuana for medical purposes?
It's not even possibly deemed.
Your timing is different, though. It's a different type of test case that's going to work, right?
No, these guys were guys who could pay a legal fee. These were drug. These were dealers. They were arrested with large quantities of marijuana here.
1968.
And so the thing that makes, from the judge's point, here I'm a municipal court judge. No, actually, I'm a superior court judge. Superior court judge. What's my job? I get up in the morning, I go and I do a bunch of cases. It's a kind of grind, it's all that. This case comes along. What's different about this case? Well, for one thing that's different about this case
is there's a lawyer in it, like Silverglade, who's willing to put on a pretty interesting show. Actually will make the argument in a way that backs the judge up, so the judge isn't making the argument himself or herself. The lawyer is the one that's offering to put on the show. The judge simply has to say, I'll let you go forward. And you notice the judge does let him go forward to make the hearing, then rules against, but pushes the question forward. This judge knows a decision at this level isn't going to decide anything. So this judge is effectively colluding with Silverglade to make a record to go up on an appeal. So what did you think of the way, well, I don't know, you haven't, let's just look.
It's actually a pretty interesting appeal. I'm sorry, I have it here with all the footnotes. But basically what the SJC does here is they march through and they knock down every argument. And then you get down to the very bottom, and there's a very interesting concurrence. I concur in the conclusions reached on all of the points discussed in the opinion, knocking down all of the arguments. The findings of the judge contain much that is highly informative on a currently controversial subject. I have grave misgivings, however, about the propriety and scope of the hearing in the Superior Court. These misgivings have been increased rather than dispelled by the majority's treatment of the reported question. Implicit in the hearing and in the opinion is the assumption that on the record of the case before it, the judicial department of the government had the power to institute and to pursue to a conclusion an inquiry to establish that there was a factual foundation for the judgment made by the general court, the legislature. And he disagrees with this. In other words, he's saying implicit in the fact that the court took the referral of the question from the Superior Court seriously and addressed it on the record that the Superior Court had made, at least validates the assumption that the court could have come out the other way if the record had been different. And this guy is disagreeing with that. But this is just one judge, and the rest of them don't concur with him. So you could come off this opinion thinking that if you found another judge at a later time who would allow you to build another record, and that other record that you built could be stronger than the one that was built here, that as a matter of power at least, this same process could be followed and produce a different conclusion. So take a look then at the Mercou case. Mercou is a case that's brought 1978, that's 10 years later. This one's brought by a declaratory judgment procedure. Very interesting procedures in Massachusetts for getting these things up. And you might think that this would just get completely brushed off. I mean, why is the court 10 years later spending any time whatsoever on this question? This is Judge Kaplan writing. This is Ben Kaplan from our faculty who became a judge on that court. And yes, it doesn't win. But the court has increasing engagement with the issue and really gets itself embroiled on the expanding right of privacy in the meantime that's taken place. And you feel, at least I feel, in reading this opinion, a continuing kind of sympathy, empathy for the raising of the issue, wishing at some level, it seems to me, that there was a better resolution of it than the one that is currently filling up Massachusetts prisons with all sorts of people, that sensible judges who are sending them away probably think is heavier than it ought to be. At least it's got that potential to it. Yes, Andrew?
Does Mass have mandatory sentencing guidelines for marijuana possession?
I have no idea. I don't know what the Massachusetts sentencing law is. I'd be surprised.
I mean, it would seem to me that, like, at least from like that would be as a judge where I would see it would be appropriate to exercise your discretion in terms of judgment, in terms of recognizing as a miscarriage of justice someone gets caught with, you know, weed or something, and if it's against the laws of the legislation is enacted, then you, you know, bang the gavel and you give them, you know, a $1 fine and, you know, let it go or something.
Yeah, that would be a form of communication. One of many possibilities, I would agree. All right, so what I was hoping you might do, just as a kind of exercise, is see if you could cast an argument on the template of the Zenger case in this context. That is, really go back through the, it'd be a wonderful exercise, go back through the transcript of Zenger as you have it. And instead of having Hamilton arguing against seditious libel, have him arguing against, in this case, the imposition of the marijuana law. And see if you could get to a point where you thought it was even plausible. Yeah?
Can we choose a different defendant? Like kind of...
I think not. I think I've been thinking about that, and it's a very interesting argument that Andrew makes, saying that this guy is the worst possible defendant, and that what you want is some really sympathetic person. And in part I find it interesting because so much of the privacy arguments that you see having some traction in Mercou are involved with the home. And here this is out on the common. But the problem with that is that you can't protest in the home. There's no way that you can take a kind of affirmative stance in that home situation in a way that has public protest associated with it. So the form of public protest that this guy's engaging in is going out in the public place and getting busted and making a speech about it. Basically saying, we ought to stand up to the authority and take our punishment. It's kind of like, it's a Gandhian approach. He's ready to be prosecuted and kind of make the system prosecute it. So in a sense, I see the potential unattractiveness from the point of view of, all right, this guy seems to be a professional. But on the other hand, it seems to me that it's going to have to be part of the argument that somehow this is
this is a way of protesting that's just outside the norms of protest, and that can be arguably within the form that you could appeal to a jury to recognize as civil disobedience. It's a kind of a protest activity where it has as its design appealing to a jury.
I think that the principle that resonates with the judges here, kind of the privacy principle, the home, these kinds of ideals, seem to be different than the protest principle. And while protest principle is kind of highlighting, it's a way, it's a methodology for kind of highlighting the other principles, the kind of ones that really resonate. It feels like one of the reasons why Sanger was so successful was that this was a case where it really resonated with people, and this was a guy who was, you know, writing a newspaper at a time when the governor was being bad, and like he kind of really highlighted that freedom principle. So that's why I think if you have a defendant who really highlights that kind of the stuff that resonates, the, you know, the privacy, the right to, you know, liberty, like I want to be able to live.
Now he's got to win on the merits of an appeal to people to say that marijuana should be legalized. At least individual people's right to smoke marijuana should be legalized. That is the argument that he's got to make, I think, to win over a juror. I don't see a juror voting for him if the juror hasn't been brought to think that it would be a good thing if marijuana was decriminalized.
How many jurors do you have?
One.
Yeah.
You have to go further than that. I mean, really, you have to shift the framework and say that the issue at stake is whether or not democracy is working, whether or not the law in its current form is actually reflective of what people want it to be. And I think it's only if you can make that argument successfully that it's not, the law is not what it should be, based on, you know, I don't know, statistics.
No, I agree with that.
That's when you make the case. But if the issue is the law and the interpretation of the law, I don't think you can win.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. And you may not be able to win in the way you have to win if you're going to win. That's perfectly plausible.
I think there is a legitimate theoretical kind of philosophical arguments made too about liberty and kind of rights of individuals and stuff like that. You don't have, I mean, I think the economic argument is another one. But I mean, the idea of like the government kind of imposing their will excessively over the individual is a legitimate right. And that's where you can make a constitutional argument, right? Appealing to principles.
Yeah, I think that the constitutional argument is harder to win than the jury, the opportunity to talk to the jury. And it's not at all clear to me that winning the opportunity to talk to the jury gets you a win. It just gives you a chance of a win. It gives you the opportunity to talk to a jury and ask them to acquit you. All right, I wanted to do an op-ed thing with you, but I think at this point I'm probably too late to jump into it. But, All right, so let me talk a bit about the projects. I think it's going to be difficult for us to organize from here to the end unless there's somehow a remarkable amount of good faith and cooperation from you in doing it, because somebody's got to go first, and then somebody's got to go second, and somebody's got to go third. And so how we actually order the presentation of project is difficult, and it's possible, if there's no other way of doing it, and just draw numbers out of a hat and let it be arbitrary. But it all may also be possible that some people like to get it out of the way early and test out their ideas and get feedback and have something good to work on for a while, and other people don't feel like they're anywhere close even to presenting an argument in class and saying how they would project it and would like more time. And so I was just thinking I would put the issue on the table with you of how we order the presentation of projects. Andrew, you have a suggestion.
Actually, I have a question. What are you looking for in terms of presentation?
I think that's a very good question. I think that I would like you to make an argument and really make it so that you're not talking about making it. You're actually making it.
In terms of...
kind of like an Ames competition, except it doesn't have to be on a law thing with precedents and all that kind of stuff. It's an argument for a proposition, but really making the argument.
Handouts, PowerPoint presentation.
Basically, however you want to do it. You're going to have the room. You have the room and you have the facility, and you can use what you want to put it across.
That will depend on how much, you know, how some people need to go, how much preparation they'll need in terms of preparing materials.
Yes, I can definitely imagine.
So maybe the best thing for us to do would be sort of edit the wiki and sort of sort ourselves out into different time slots. Is the scheduling issue the main issue?
Basically, scheduling issue is the main issue, yeah.
I have a question. How actually legal do our arguments need to be? Like, what the idea that I had in mind is more of a, it's a legal topic, but it's more based upon public opinion than anything else. It's based on, well, the idea I had, I missed last Tuesday, so I didn't want to talk about it. The idea I had was talking about the conviction of the media of athletes before they're actually convicted of any crimes, using recent cases to illustrate how in some cases it actually works, but in other cases where it can be tragic, where players or people are just, they're held up to these unreachable standards to where they lose everything before they're even convicted of anything. So for me, like, there's no real, like, actual, like, I'm not citing legal precedent and trying to get a change legally, but it's more about getting a change in terms of how the media perceives the athletes. Like, I actually talked to, I'm not sure if anyone here reads the sports law blog, but it's probably the leading sports law blog on the net, and I talked to the person who creates it. He's willing to allow me to use it as a forum to post about this topic. So I'm not sure, like, that's like a kind of like a change, but it's more of like just to the readers of this, but it's not really like a legal change that's been trying to be made. So I'm not sure, like, how that would be presented. Like, would it be me presenting my case or just using examples, illustrations?
Well, it certainly sounds interesting. I'm not sure I hear exactly what the argument is, but it sounds like there's an argument in there for something, so that you, in terms of addressing a group of people with an argument, it sounds like it is amenable to that. Assume that they start some way and move them to something with whatever you're, and it sounds like
I'll have to come up with some solution to, like, how we...
Yeah, you've got some very good ammunition there. And then it sounds like you've got the beginning of thoughts about how you would want to project it. You're already thinking about a medium in which there'd be an audience that would be attracted to this. And so that thinking through and talking that through and seeing how that could be done, that sounds like just what I'm talking about. All right, so I do think it would be useful to think about this and use the wiki in some way. I'll put up a schedule. You can fill it in, and that will be excellent, actually. All right, so we have this conference coming up on Saturday, to which you're cordially invited. I have to say, increasingly into the idea of actually putting forward a hypothetical construction of how an online environment could work. And in that environment, asking the question, what's to stop it? Much like the power question here, we can build this. Who stops us? Where are the points?
But this thing's always the where you stop yourself. This thing's, isn't the question always where you stop yourself?
Yes.
And most times, like the online environment question. And the proposal there, I guess, would be to create an environment where there'd be a financial incentive to learn in terms of poker. Like, it would just be a question not so much of who would stop you, so much as what's the potential public backlash, and to what degree do you need to stop yourself in order to avoid it?
Or how you structure what you're doing so as to minimize it. Yes, I agree with that.
Are you talking about a database model or something like that?
No, actually not. Where?
Crazier than that. Much crazier than that.
Yeah, no. It's basically starting a school in which you train people to win and then take a share of what they win. That's the business model. Sure.
I read a story about one of them. I can't remember his exact name, but he's Vietnamese, and he trains all these guys to play. But for life, they have to pay 10%. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. They cheat like hell.
Yeah, I heard that too. They're also pretty good.
He's no longer allowed to play in mainstream tournaments.
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
All right, I'll see you all next week.
You have a chance to do it in the last 2 hours.
Sorry?
You have a chance to do it in the last 2 hours?
No.
What
about that?
It's small. It's small. I don't want to
yeah. What's the problem?
Let's do the deal. It's not a big problem. They're concerned about the associated area. They want nothing to do with the teaching of children. And it's on the it's on the website that the political stuff has them very nervous. In fact, they want made very, very clear that
does judicial discretion really not bother you?
I feel to some extent it's a system that's built to